MechCast, Wednesday, June 4th, 2014. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, this is going to be a little bit of, I don't want to say different show, but it's going to be a big show. It's going to be a fun show and a little more loose, I guess, than most MechCast shows. Maybe a little bit like the keynote that we're going to be talking about. That is, of course, the WWDC keynote. Worldwide Developers Conference is going on right now in San Francisco. It happens all week on Monday. Tim Cook and his team at Apple took the stage to deliver the keynote, and in a word, it was amazing. I'm sure many of you have seen it and watched it. If you haven't, it is available on Apple's website. It's also available on your Apple TV. You can find it in the keynote podcast on iTunes. So there's many ways to view it. I think they even just posted it to YouTube. So there's no shortage of viewing options for you if you'd like. But we're going to dive into sort of everything that was announced. I'm going to give you some of my thoughts and opinions on the various things. I'm sure you have some of your own opinions. And if you'd like to share those with us, please shoot me an email, comment about anything, any particular topic, the event as a whole, what's happening with macOS 10, 10.10, and iOS 8, along with the developer updates. One of the things about the conference that was immediately apparent was, one, it was going to be about software, which I always knew. There was a lot of speculation that Apple was going to dive in and they might announce some new piece of hardware, but I didn't think that was going to happen. I guess we had the kind of the little off precedence thing that happened last year when they announced the Mac Pro, I believe, at WWDC. Hopefully I'm remembering that correctly. I think I am. But this time around, it was all about the software. Even more importantly, and something that was divergent, and we'll talk about this too, is it was about developers. They had a whole section on developers and some changes that are, and all the changes that are happening with the SDKs and those sorts of things. And that was pretty exciting to see. So all in all, I think a lot of us are coming away very excited about the future of Apple. And they showed we don't have to show off new hardware to really make an impact. So many people have been calling for that. And we can talk about some of the reasons why or why not in future episodes of the MacCast. A lot of that analysis is coming out now too. But obviously, we have a lot of things to get into, a lot of things to talk about. Before we do that, though, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And that is Gazelle. And I've been telling you about Gazelle for a really long time. You know, the reason I love Gazelle is because they do one of my favorite things, which is taking a process that I dread, selling my old stuff, and they make it painless. And yeah, I could do it myself. There's all kinds of services you can sign up for. You can do online classifieds. You can do private sales, those sorts of things. Maybe even get a little bit more money. But my thing is, why? Because that is such a hassle. All of that stuff takes so much time and effort. You have to worry about things like emails, haggling back and forth, dealing with shipping, meeting up with somebody, worrying about getting ripped off. There's even, in this day and age, some security, privacy concerns, those sorts of things. Gazelle takes that all off the table, and they make the process completely simple. Search, get your offer, ship it in, get paid. That's really it. That's the whole entire process, and that's really why I love it. So if you have an old iPod, an iPhone, an iPad, an old Mac, even older Android devices and tablets and things like that that you'd like to get some cash for, check out Gazelle. You just go to gazelle.com. You do a simple search. You answer a couple questions about the condition, what accessories you have. You know, do you have the charger? Do you have the cables? Those sorts of things. Answer those, and then they give you an offer. They say, hey, we'll give you this much for it in this condition. Take it or leave it. If you choose to take their offer, they even handle the shipping, and in some cases, we'll give you a box. You send it in. And when they receive it, you get paid quickly. They'll even buy broken items, and you get paid by check, PayPal, or Amazon gift card. I like the Amazon gift card option because they give you 5% more on your offer. And you, if you're like me and use Amazon Prime, it makes it really convenient. It goes right into your Amazon account, and then you can spend it on the stuff that you want. It's really, really cool. So if you have that old Apple product, cell phone, tablet, you want to turn that into cash, give Gazelle a try, gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So let's get in and talk about WWDC. I'm going to kind of run through it like I usually do after these things, just going through the same sorts of sections and things that Apple did during the keynote. Tim Cook kicked things off, came on stage, and it was immediately apparent that it was going to be a little more lighthearted, a little less serious. All of the executives seemed really thrilled. And really, why shouldn't they be? Apple's been doing great lately. And this is actually the 25th anniversary of the conference. I did not realize that they had been doing WWDC for 25 years. And they noted at that original conference that they had just one lab. And I think it was the time when Mac OS 7, not iOS 7, but Mac OS 7 was being released. And they, I guess I should back up a little bit, too. They had played this great intro video sort of thanking developers for all of their hard work and efforts and things like that. But that first conference was really small. Now they have over 1,000 engineers. They're doing over 120 labs. They have attendees from 96 countries. And the youngest developer in the room was just 13. They had a scholarship program, and Tim did a nice thing and welcomed and thanked the scholarship owners, or recognized the scholarship winners, rather, for attending the conference. And I thought that was pretty cool. They had 9 million registered developers, which was up 47% from last year. So a lot of new developers coming into that Apple ecosystem. And I think they said 2/3 of the attendees at the conference were first timers at that conference. And then they reiterated, hey, this is going to be all about OS X and iOS, and more importantly, all the things that these next versions of the operating system are going to do to bring the two operating systems together, to get them working, not together like Microsoft together, right? But getting them more cohesive, making it easier to move from one device to the other, working on that seamless thing. And then he announced there was going to be a third section, which is going to be all about developers. And he called it the mother of all releases for developers. And as we now know, that's definitely true. A lot going on with the development environment. We'll get to that last. But I want to kick things off, starting off a little bit about what's happening with Mac OS 10, 10.10. And I need to go back. I've watched it twice now, but I don't think I caught them at any point calling Mac OS 10.10 actually 10.10. So I had joked on the past few episodes that we were going to call it Triple 10 or Mac OS 10 cubed or what have you. But it looks like they're going to just stick with the new naming they have on famous places in California, or landmarks in California, I guess is sort of what they're basing their new naming on, moving away from the big cats. And Craig Federighi, when he came out to present Mac OS 10 and the new name, had a little fun with that. And again, there was a very sort of joking, jovial ring to kind of the whole presentation of everything, which was really interesting. I mean, Apple's done little funny bits and made little comments and jokes here, back and forth here and there, but they really kind of went over the top on this keynote. And I think for people watching, because there's been some backlash, because specifically Tim Cook kind of made some pretty hard jabs at some of their competitors and did it in a way that to some kind of came off as a little bit arrogant. And I was talking with, I think it was John Martellaro over at the Mac Observer, and he brought up a really good point saying, you know, Apple is streaming this keynote live, but really the event is for developers. And if you look at who they're talking to and who they're targeting, the people at the room, it's Mac developers and iOS developers. And the idea here is to get them excited about the platform that they're working in, to sort of pump them up to develop all of this great software. So if you kind of take it in that context rather than the more global context, you know, they're really talking at developers. This isn't an ad that's going out on primetime television taking these kinds of jabs at Apple's competitors. So you're in a little bit more sheltered environment when you're making those statements. But at the same time, you would think Apple knows that they're live streaming this, that they have a lot of eyeballs on them right now just because of their position in the marketplace. And so some of that stuff did come off a little harsh. But frankly, being an Apple fanboy, being the Apple fanboy I am, I actually kind of enjoyed the jokes and stuff like that. So they kick things right off talking about the operating system and the naming And so they threw out some funny names like they did last year when they talked about the transition. Ultimately, it landed on Mac OS X Yosemite, which was one of the rumored names we had been hearing about. So it wasn't all that surprising. And then he kind of laid out what Apple had focused on for this release of Mac OS X, breaking it down into kind of three different places where they focused their energy. And it was the user interface, which we knew that was going to get some cleaning up and sprucing up with Johnny Ive and his team working on that. They focused on apps, and then finally continuity, what they're calling continuity, which is this idea of seamlessly transitioning between your mobile devices and your Mac. So there's a bunch of technologies surrounding that. So kicking things off with the user interface definitely is flatter, but not flat. I don't think they took it as extreme as they did with iOS 7. And I have to say, I think the new user interface personally looks amazing. It looks really clean, really crisp, but they really didn't diverge too much. It still looks like Mac OS X. So I think consumers are not going to be as shocked by it as they were with the transition from iOS 6 to iOS 7. It has all those hints back to the Mac OS X that we know and love, just cleaned up and refined, definitely flat. They talked a lot about their use of translucency. They're using translucency in the sidebars and in the menu bars, so you kind of see your desktop background peeking through. I'm not so sure how that's going to work in actual application, depending upon the kinds of backgrounds you like and things like that. That can be a little bit distracting. But it looks like they did put some heavy opacity on it in terms of light opacity. It's not super opaque. It's kind of more of this sort of frosted glass effect, and it's a pretty heavily frosted glass effect. So it's just very, very subtle, the way that Apple likes to sort of do those sorts of things. And so all of Apple's core apps are going to be taking on that kind of new appearance. And I would assume that a lot of third-party developers and things like that are going to follow suit with their application. One thing that they just briefly touched on but is being talked about a lot, though, is they're changing the system-level font to a new font. And I'm not sure, I was trying to find the exact font that they're using. Apple always takes in a kind of an existing font and sort of tweaks it. I think it looks like it's maybe a tweaked version of Helvetica New, but I'm not really certain on that. It's nice and geometric, very clean, but more importantly, it looked like Apple paid a lot of attention to the spacing and the kerning and things like that. There was a lot of detail put into the typography of the new operating system, and that's going to help with not only readability and those sorts of things, but it just looks really nice. I mean, you look at the screenshots and things like that, and it just looks gorgeous. It looks really, really beautiful. So I thought they did a really nice job with that. Something that got a lot of people excited, they talked about the fact that some people don't like the bright white, especially designers and things like that, so they're going to be releasing a new dark mode. It kind of has more of a smoked glass appearance. So you can have frosted glass or smoked glass. You'll be able to take your pick when the operating system comes out. They did some significant tweaks over to Notification Center. It's using the darker styling like it currently does, but they're adding in the Today view. This was sort of the first hint we saw of them sort of merging in some of the iOS features back into Mac OS X. So you're going to have that Today view, but even bigger, they announced that they're adding support for widgets in the sidebar. What I'm curious, when I heard that announcement, the very first thing I was curious about, and I haven't seen anybody really talk about, probably because they're under NDA, is does that mean the dashboard's going away in Mac OS X Yosemite? I would assume that it is, because it looks like third-party developers are going to be able to build little widgets. They even showed pulling things out like the calculator and putting that right into the Notification Center sidebar. So you'll have a little editor, you'll be able to go in and add and remove different widgets and things like that from your sidebar so you can get you the information you want. So if you want sports scores from, say, ESPN or something like that, you'll be able to have a little widget in there, and applications will be able to make those widgets available to the new Notification Center. There were a lot of changes to Spotlight. They really expanded and really changed Spotlight to be a centralized search, not just for your documents and local information, but for everything. So you still have the magnification glass up in the upper right-hand corner in your toolbar, But when you activate Spotlight now, it comes up right in the center of the screen. Right in the middle of the screen is a little floating palette. And as you start doing your search, it's going to give you your typical Spotlight search. The searches results that you're used to, like your documents and files and things like that. But then also right in there, it's going to offer up web-based searches, information, dictionary, all those sorts of things. You'll be able to get stuff like Yelp data. It can search the iTunes store and the App Store, so you can find apps through Spotlight searches. And they're even allowing conversions, which was something I was very excited to see. I've been wanting conversions in Spotlight for a while. We've been able to do things like math and look up dictionary definitions, but you're actually going to be able to do conversions from, say, imperial to metric and those sorts of things. I would assume you'd also be able to get things like currency conversions right from the Spotlight search. And when you look at the information, it even gets to the point where if you're looking at a Wikipedia result, you can see that right in the window. So Spotlight comes out, it has your Wikipedia result. When you click on it, it displays it all within the Spotlight search pane, much in the same way that you get when you're doing, say, a Siri search on your iOS device. So if you have Siri look for photos or something like that, they're going to show right up in the Siri interface. Very similar thing coming to the desktop and Mac OS X. And I thought this was brilliant, and it really, a lot of people are pointing out, and I think rightly so, it goes after Google in a really big way, because when you think about it, if you're doing a Google search, Google makes their money from the ads and things that you're going to see within the search results. This completely obfuscates the search. It puts it on the desktop, and you're not going to see any of those ads. Now, it looks like none of the data in the Spotlight search is actually coming from Google. It looks like Apple mostly partnered with Yahoo and Microsoft, also Wolfram Alpha and other sources. So it's a lot of Bing stuff. And so there's been some people saying, well, you know, we don't really like that, or we don't think that's a good thing. I've talked about on the show, I think a little bit in the past, and I think at WWDC, we're going to talk about this more later in the show, Apple's really pushed in a big way the fact that the data is going to come from these different places, but it's really going to be branded as an Apple experience. So most of us, I don't think, really ultimately care where the data or information comes from, as long as the information is accurate, it's the information that we want, and we can get at it quickly. And that's what Apple's doing here with Spotlight, right? You'll be able to search for an image, and it'll show right up in Spotlight. If I want an image of a cat, if it shows me images of cats, that's all I really care about. I don't care that it came from Bing or Google or what have you, right? It's not the brand that's behind it. It's how it's presented. And that's why a lot of people like Google, right? They made this clean, simple search. So Apple is kind of having that, but then they're also able to leverage all the other partnerships, all the other data and information, and give you everything that you want in one single place. And I don't want to downplay the significance of that. And this is just in one area where they're doing that. As I was watching the keynote unfold, and as I was doing all the research afterwards, I realized this is a really huge thing in aggregate. And Apple has a plan, and it has a strategy for taking this, not just at the search level, but taking it at a whole operating system and a whole device level that's going to be really, really big going forward. The last thing I want to talk about on the user interface that really got me was, I was glad that I think I mentioned this on the We Have Communicators podcast. I was glad that they updated the stoplights, the little red, yellow, and green icons in your windows to do things like close, maximize, and minimize, and your windows. One significant change is now the little green window button by default is going to put your window into full screen mode. So they got rid of the little full screen on the upper right hand corner of the window, and they moved that to the green stoplight icon. But the icons are really nice. They're flattened, really, really elegant. You hover over them, you get the little symbols like you did before. So you get the little X over the red one, you get the little minus sign over the minimize one, and now you'll see the little double arrow for going to full screen mode on the green one. My guess, and they kind of showed this, but they didn't mention it, there was a graphic that showed the green icon with the plus symbol on it. So my guess is that if you hold down the option key, you'll probably be able to maximize the window using that green button as well. So it's going to probably serve a dual purpose, but I'm just guessing at that. That hasn't been released or publicized yet, but it seems to make sense, and especially since they kind of showed that icon being in there. Then they went through some of the new app features, things like that. Calendar is getting some updates with a new look for the day and week views. I'm a busy Cal guy, so I don't use the calendar on a daily basis, so it was hard for me to see what those changes were. Big announcement, though, comes in the way of the Finder and more specifically iCloud. They mentioned that they are going to have something called iCloud Drive, so they're finally opening up iCloud to be more like other services like Box.net and Dropbox like that. At least that's what it seems like to me. So in the Finder, you're going to be able to have the folders that have all of your iCloud data in them. You're going to be able to see them organized by apps. They even showed kind of having app icons on there. So this gets in later to that integration with iOS. So if I have an iOS application that's saving documents to the iCloud, I'm going to see that on my Mac desktop in a folder with that application's icon on there, and I can go in and I can create subfolders. I can do all of the normal Finder things that I want to do. And that got a lot of applause from the audience. I think a lot of us have been really wanting that. So it's going to include your iOS documents and your Mac documents. You're finally going to be able to get at those things and move seamlessly back and forth from one to the other. You can organize them the way that you want. And they also announced that that is going to work on Windows. I'm not sure if that's just going to require a web interface or if they're actually going to have a Windows iCloud Drive client like they had back in the old days when we had iCloud. Remember, they had an iCloud client for Windows. But that was another running theme, is there seems to be a lot more support for certain features on Windows-based systems as well, which I think is going to be really great for those of us who have to work on Windows and work on Mac and move back and forth between the two different platforms. Some really nice new features and enhancements for Mail were also mentioned. They're going to have a new thing called Mail Drop, which deals with the whole attachment problem. You know, when you try and send a large attachment via email, and then it warns you that, hey, you're not going to be able to send this because there's restrictions on the server. Apple has a new way to handle that. So you're going to be able to use iCloud to actually store those messages or those attachments. So it'll put your attachment up in iCloud. It'll know it's associated with that email. If you send it to someone on the Mac, on their end, it'll just automatically get pulled down. So they'll see it as they normally do. It'll look like just an attachment to the mail. On Windows-based platforms or other platforms that aren't Apple platforms, you'll just have a link and you'll be able to pull that down directly from the iCloud account. So that's Mail Drop. And another nice feature that they're adding in is markup. You'll be able to have little drawing and annotation tools. So if you put in an image, you can actually write inside Mail, do quick little annotations, notes, and things like that. That's going to be great for working collaboratively. Also, that will work with PDF documents as well. I think some people probably wonder if that's sort of encroaching on, say, one of my favorite software applications, PDF Pen Pro. They even showed doing things like signing documents right inside Mail, so putting in your signatures. You know, Preview has had those features for a while, but, you know, they're still somewhat limited. So I think Apple's going to kind of give you the basics. Tools like PDF Pen Pro, things like that, have a lot more features, a lot more advanced. They're really different tools in my mind, so I don't think anybody should feel threatened sort of by what Apple's doing. They're just adding some convenience for those of us who need to sort of email and send our documents back and forth. And then the last app that kind of talked about in any kind of significant detail was Safari. Safari's got a redesign. It's got a new minimal toolbar. Actually, it looks like all of the toolbars in Apple's default applications in Mac OS X have this new minimized toolbar. You kind of no longer have the title bar at the top that's sort of been removed and moved off to the side and really cleaned up, which I kind of like. It allows it to be a little bit shorter, a little bit more compact. In Safari, they have a new smart search bar. And again, they're extending the kind of concepts that they had for search in Spotlight search into the Safari search bar. And again, John Martellaro over at the Mac Observer, I didn't even catch this. He pointed out that in the language, as they were presenting that, it's no longer the URL bar. They're calling it the search bar. And that has a little bit of weight and significance, right? Apple is saying, hey, this is search on Safari or in Safari on your Mac, Apple Search, right? But again, the data is coming from all kinds of different places. It's not necessarily all Apple's data, but they're going to present it to you right there from the search bar. And they also noted that the bookmarks bar has been moved into part of that search bar. So when you click on it, you'll see all of the items that are in your bookmarks bar. If you want to get the bookmarks bar back, you can get it back within the interface. But you know, now you don't need to have it. So again, it's going to really clean up the search bar at the top. But then as you do your search, you're going to have searches from all those different locations, again, including places like the App Store and Wikipedia and all those partners that Apple's working with. If I'm doing an image search, it's going to be able to, I'm assuming, return my images right there without having to actually leave the browser, go to another website, Google Images, say. And so you can start to see how this is really going to kind of a shot across the bow, as a lot of people are pointing out, of Google's search business. Apple's going to be taking away some of that search stuff. And I think consumers are going to love it. Google's not going to be necessarily so thrilled about it. And it's interesting too, because Google still is a search partner with Apple. It is the default search on Safari still, because even during the presentation, he said, oh yeah, and if you're using the smart search bar and you know, you don't want this information, you want to do a quote-unquote plain old Google search, you can still do that, right? Something to that effect. That was sort of how the language was laid out. Very, very interesting. They've extended the private browsing feature. This is kind of cool. You can now have separate private browsing windows. So rather than having to put the whole browser into private browsing mode, you can just have a specific window of information maybe you want to keep private, and that extends to tabs. So you could have private tabs or private browsing windows. And HTML5 premium video with Netflix. So if you like watching Netflix on your Mac, it's sounding like they're getting rid of Spotlight for a Mac, or Spotlight, excuse me, they're getting rid of Silverlight for Mac users. You're no longer going to have to rely on that old Microsoft Silverlight technology. You're going to be able to stream HTML5 video right inside the browser from Netflix. And they said, with the efficiencies and things like that, you can even get 2 hours longer battery life when doing 1080p video. I'm not sure how all that works technically. It's like magic mojo stuff, but that is really, really cool. And then your tab bar is now scrolling. So we don't have to have that little, always bothered me, that little button that you'd click on with the, it was a double or triple arrows up there in the upper right. If you've got too many tabs open and then it kind of drops down and shows you the other tabs, now you just flick back and forth along that tab bar and it will just scroll so you can get at all your different tabs. So some nice little updates to the apps. I'm sure there's a lot more we're going to be hearing about in the coming weeks and things like that. And we'll be talking about more of that. But really the big news, I think, with macOS, well, the user interface stuff is pretty big, but even the bigger news, I think, with macOS 10 Yosemite is this concept Apple's calling continuity. Having the right device at the right moment and being able to transition really seamlessly between one and the other. We've kind of had both devices and we've had these kind of kludgy ways to kind of get stuff back and forth. If you're like me, you use stuff like Dropbox or your transporter and you can kind of get back and forth, but it's a little bit cumbersome, right? So Apple's trying to take some of that, those pain points away from us in these new releases. And I think they've done a really nice job. The very first place they started, and again, uproarious applause, I don't know why we haven't had this from the very beginning, AirDrop. We can now AirDrop between iOS and Mac, move documents and AirDrop things back and forth completely seamlessly. That seemed like a no-brainer. Finally, we're going to get it in macOS 10 Yosemite. But then there's this other cool technology that Apple showed off called Handoff. And it allows you to, if you're working on a document on one device or on your Mac, to seamlessly pick up working on that document or file on the other device. And it's really interesting the way it works. It uses proximity to kind of detect what devices are near you and what applications is watching what applications and documents that you're working on. So say you're working on an iWork document, you're working on a Pages document on your Mac and your iPad's sitting there next to you, your iPad's gonna have a little Pages document in the lower left corner and you can simply swipe up on that. It will launch right into Pages, right into the document that you're currently working on. You can pick up your iPad and start working on it there. Say if you need to jump and walk away from your computer, something like that. On the Mac, it's the same kind of thing. Say I'm working on an email on my iPhone. I start composing it. Maybe something happens. I'm walking into my office. Now I'm sitting in front of my Mac. You know, it's much easier for me to finish this on my Mac. Down in my dock, there's going to be a little icon knowing that I was working on this mail on my iPhone. I can click on it. It'll open up mail. It'll have the mail that I'm working on right there. I can finish it up, maybe add some attachments and send it off, all completely seamlessly. And that is really cool. And it's going to work with Mail, Safari, iWork, Photos. It looks like most of Apple's built-in applications. And then I'm assuming third-party apps will be able to leverage this and work with the handoff feature as well. So there'll be some APIs that can be tied in. So we're going to be able to move seamlessly, you know, with our documents now in the Finder and iCloud documents, those sorts of things, and features like handoff. You can see how workflows become much simpler when you're moving between devices, and we're doing that more and more. So this kind of seems like a great next transition. Another feature of handoff that's really cool has to do with those of us who have iPhones. If you have an iPhone, your iPhone can now be the gateway for your Mac for things like messages, specifically SMS messages. So we've been able to do iMessages from the Mac if the people that we're texting with have iMessage, but if they're just on an Android phone or some other device that only gets SMS, that's been difficult. Now you'll actually be able to get those on your Mac through your phone. So you'll be able to go back and forth, and that extends into phone calls as well. So your iPhone can act as this gateway. You can make phone calls from your Mac. You can receive phone calls on your Mac all through the handoff feature that's going to be in Mac OS X Yosemite. So that's going to be fun to play around with. Another thing that I use quite frequently with my iPhone is the hotspot feature. So if I'm out and about, I'm at a place and they don't have Wi-Fi, or maybe the Wi-Fi is locked down and I don't want to bother getting the password, I like to use the mobile hotspot on my iPhone. They now have a feature called Instant Hotspot. So the tricky part always is, right, you got to go into your phone, you got to turn on the hotspot, you got to go back to your Mac, you got to click on the Wi-Fi icon, you've got to connect to it, all those sorts of things. Now you'll be able to initiate the hotspot right from the Wi-Fi menu on your Mac. So you go up to the Wi-Fi menu, it'll recognize that your iPhone with hotspot features available is close by. You'll pick it as a network, and it will automatically activate the hotspot and get you up and connected. So that's going to be a lot quicker way to handle that sort of stuff. A few other extras that sort of came out after all the big announcements. iOS devices are now going to be able to be seen as camera inputs on your Mac. So if you want to be able to do screenshots or even capture like screencast video of what's going on in your iOS device, you'll be able to use, say, QuickTime's feature to do that. So it'll see your iOS desktop as a camera input. You'll be able to pick that like it was a camera and just simply capture and record that. And that's really going to be helpful for another feature that they announced, and we'll talk about here in a second, in the iOS portion called Previews, which is a way for developers to actually do quick videos and make those available on the App Store to show the features and functionality of their applications. It is being said with this camera recording feature that currently, in the current iteration, performance is going to need a little bit of tweaking, so it's a little bit kludgy, a little bit early stages, but nice new feature, especially those of us who are, you know, need to show people things. Do little training videos or demos with our iPhones or iPads. It's going to make that process a little bit easier. As far as what Macs OS X Yosemite is going to run on, the requirements I thought were pretty liberal. iMacs mid-2007 and later, MacBook Pros 13-inch aluminum late 2008 or early 2009 and later, the MacBook Pro 13-inch mid-2009 or later, 15-inch mid to late 2007 and later, 17-inch models of the MacBook Pro 2007 and later. If you have any MacBook Air late 2008 or later, Mac Mini is going to be early 2009 or later, Mac Pros early 2008 or later, and once again, X serves, I guess those are still out there and running, early 2009 or later models. I think those might have been the last models of the X-Serve, if memory is serving me right. So a wide range of Macs are going to be able to run Mac OS X Yosemite. I have to go back and compare that to the ones that can run OS X Mavericks. I'm thinking it might be a very similar list, if not exactly the same list. I'm sure some of you can fill me in on that one. And it is available to developers right now, and they're going to have a public release in the fall, and it's going to be free, and something Apple has not done in a while, I don't think since the original Mac OS X, they did a beta program, a public beta program. They're going to do public beta of Mac OS X Yosemite, and you can sign up for it if you go to apple.com/OSX/preview. They're going to let 1 million people into the public beta program, and all you have to do is sign up. So if you want to get early release, that's going to happen sometime this summer for the general public. I will just caution you, it is beta, and I'm really worried, and I think a lot of developers are worried about this, because they're already getting support calls and people telling them, hey, your thing doesn't run on OS X Yosemite. Well, it was just announced 2 days ago. Right? Or two days ago at this point. Of course, it's not going to run. We haven't updated our application for Mac OS X Yosemite. So they're already getting support calls now just from developers who are jumping on board. Now they're going to have to, this summer, deal with 1 million consumers installing this thing. So if you do plan to do the beta, make sure you know you're getting into a beta program. Apple's going to want feedback from you. Be ready and willing to give feedback, because that's how this stuff gets better. But also recognize that a lot of your software that you're running and may rely on might not work, and probably isn't going to work, at least initially, until the developers can kind of catch up. Developers are supposed to have till the fall to get their software ready. That's the whole point of this, right? Apple gives them the preview now, and then in the fall is the release, so you have between now and the fall to get your apps ready to run on OS X Yosemite. So if you are going to get in the beta program, you probably want to have an extra Mac. You don't want to install it on your main work production machine. It's going to be broken. You're going to be dealing with a lot of bugs. You're going to have a lot of hair-pulling moments if you do that. So please don't sign up if you're not willing to sign up for that sort of thing. I'm just going to throw out that PSA right now, because I think it's going to be a real problem for developers. And we like our developers. We want them to be happy and continue to make great stuff for us. We don't want to burden them as they're trying to get their apps ready for OS X Yosemite with all of our nitpicky problems because we're running the beta, and now our machine doesn't work and we can't get work done. So don't hassle them with that stuff. So that's Mac OS X and Yosemite in a nutshell, and sort of the things I noticed about it. If you have some things that you want to comment on, be sure to shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now let's talk a little bit about the next version of iOS, iOS 8. You know, it's not going to be as big a release as we had with iOS 7. Some people are already commenting on that. We don't have all those big visual changes going on, but there's still some nice updates, some pretty significant updates happening under the hood. Notification Center is one. Again, they're going to get the same kinds of features that we're seeing in Notification Center on the Mac, and one of those really nice ones is that ability to reply to a notification right from Notification Center. So they're going to have enhanced notifications with actionable items. You'll be able to do things like delete messages, those sorts of things, and you can do all that even from the lock screen. So you'll be able to reply right away. I'm sure there's going to be some security features. So if you don't want to have those enabled on the lock screen, so that you don't have your friends, you know, replying to your text messages, you can be able to turn that off. At least I hope so. You'll be able to get direct access to your contacts through the application switcher. So people that you've texted or emailed most recently, when you double tap on the home button now, your contacts are going to show up in little circle icons right above your open applications. Something I forgot to mention when we were talking about Safari. Safari has a new, more visual tab view. So when you go in to look at all your tabs, they're going to be organized together. If you have multiple ones from the same website in little stacks, you get little visual indicators of that. That is going to be available also on the iPhone. Safari Sidebar is now on iPhone as well. So you're familiar with that on the Mac. You're going to be able to have it on your iOS devices. Again, so all of these things kind of coming into play to kind of make iOS and Mac OS X more like each other, but still separate operating systems, right? You're going to have a lot of the same interactions, the same visual cues, and that adds to this sort of cohesive experience that you're going to have. Some nice new enhancements in Mail. Mail is actually going to be able to suggest items that you might want to add to your calendar based on what's in your mail. So if you receive a mail message right there at the top of the message, it's going to say, hey, looks like this is maybe something you want to add to your calendar as an appointment. So if someone sends you a meeting request and they've mentioned the day and time, maybe even the place of the meeting, be able to put all of that right into your calendar. And right now we kind of have that, but you have to go down to the little data detector, right? You got to find the address, you got to hover over it, you got to click the little button. Now it's right there front and center at the top of your message. All kinds of new swipe gestures to be able to flag, delete, mark messages as unread. So you'll be able to do that with some simple gestures right from your email list. And one thing that I am super excited about is being able to set aside a mail that you're working on, you're currently composing, and actually get back at your email. So they have this new slide down gesture. So you know when you're composing an email and you have the compose window open, if you forgot something, maybe you wanted to reference a piece of text from another email or get a link from another email, something like that, you can't go back. You'd have to kind of save that as a draft, go back, find the email, come back to the one you're composing and paste that back in. Now you can simply slide down. It'll sort of set aside the message that you're working on composing. It'll put it there down at the bottom of your window. You can go browse through your mail, get the information that you want, copy it, and then swipe back up on that email that you were working on, put it back into place, and paste in what you need to put in there. That is going to be really helpful to someone like me because I do that all the time. I'm constantly having to kind of temporarily save a draft and go find something. Big hassle. So I was excited about that feature. That's that one I'm going to be using quite frequently. And so those were some of the quick updates to a couple different applications. Then they kind of focused on more of the what I would call the big ticket items in iOS 8. And again, Spotlight is a pretty big one. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about Apple sort of bringing all the search that we want to do into Spotlight, keeping us out of the browser, keeping us out of Google, those sorts of places. So you're going to be able to have all those Spotlight search things, points of interest, news items, music that you have in iTunes or that's available on the iTunes store, movies, whether you're looking for movie show times or it's movies that are available in iTunes. You're going to have Spotlight suggestions, App Store searches, all those sorts of things happening right in Spotlight on your device. No need to open up a browser, no need to go to another application, that sort of thing. You're going to have that right there. Another big one is Apple announced a technology that they're calling QuickType. So they're making some enhancements finally to the keyboard. It's going to be able to suggest words and will do it even before you start typing it, which is an interesting thing to think about. We've had sort of predictive keyboards. We've seen some solutions where it will suggest different words as you're typing. Apple's actually going to also look at the context of what you're working on and even going further, look at who you're maybe composing a message to, be it a text message or an email, and they're going to be able to figure out and sort of learn the writing style that you have for different people and the kinds of words that you use, and it'll start making suggestions. And so right at the top as you're composing, you kind of get three different word recommendations and you can simply just tap on those or use some swipe gestures to enable those and insert them as you're going. So it's going to learn your typing habits. It's going to adapt and change those words based on that context. And it's supposed to make typing much quicker. Now, you don't have to use the feature. Apparently, if you just hold on one of the recommended words and then swipe down, the boxes will actually hide. So if you prefer to have a more clean experience or you don't want the recommendations and suggestions, you can get them put away. You can bring them back up by simply swiping back up. And more importantly, from a privacy standpoint, they pointed out all that data. So if you're worried, hey, why, it's going to be reading my messages and looking at who I'm talking to and sort of inferring and figuring out my typing or texting style, all that data and information is kept local. It's kept on the device. It's not made available to the applications. The keyboards are not allowed to have any kind of network connection, that sort of thing. So all of that stuff's restricted. It's just used for the operating system. And it is going to support multiple languages at launch. So a lot of times Apple will announce one of these new features and it's limited to just the US for the first release. And then they kind of have to roll it out. It's not in every country, but they had a pretty nice list of countries. It looked like maybe a dozen or so show that they're going to have available at launch, and I'm sure they're going to expand it out quickly. So they announced QuickType, but then an even bigger announcement, they announced that they're going to have APIs available so that third parties can have custom keyboards that they can, that you'll now be able to swap out for Apple's default keyboard. So if you want to use something like Flesky or Swipe, some of these other keyboards that are very popular even on other platforms, Apple's finally going to allow those in iOS 8. Again, they're doing a little bit differently, though, because they are, again, sandboxed. So you'll have to, I think, it looks like the way it'll work is you'll install the application from the third-party keyboard manufacturer, and that will be made available to the operating system using some hooks and things like that. But then as the keyboard's running within the operating system, it can't do things like get access to the network without permission. So if the keyboard relies on some advanced functionality that needs network access, it's going to have to ask you to grant it that sort of permission. And all of that data and information, again, keystrokes and things like that, are going to be kept local. So Apple's going to be protecting that. And I think that's one of the reasons probably why they took a little bit longer to get the support in there, is they wanted to make sure they did it in a more safe and secure way. But a lot of people really thrilled about that. A lot of people like some of these other keyboard solutions. You'll finally be able to get those in iOS 8. And as it turns out, Flesky apparently has already made their keyboard available. You can check out their website. They are going to have a beta program. They're going to be inviting people to the beta, but they were kind of showing a demo, I think just today, of their keyboard already integrated and working with this new feature in iOS 8, which is pretty, pretty cool. Apple talked a lot more about the whole continuity thing. On the iPhone, as I already mentioned, it kind of works exactly the same with the handoff and the phone calls and things like that. You'll be able to move from one application to another. And, you know, it seems like such a simple feature, but it really is a big deal, right? Because that's really how people want to work. Microsoft's kind of finding out the hard way that this sort of concept of an all-in-one device, a thing that's a tablet and a computer at the same time, that's a tough road to go down. They may eventually get there, they may eventually get something, but a lot of people are sort of struggling with that paradigm, and it seems very natural to kind of have the right device for the right moment. That's more of what I think of as the Apple approach, right? If I'm out and about and I need to be really mobile, I'm going to have my phone with me. If I want to kick back on the couch and maybe watch a movie, get a little bit of work done, answer some emails and those sorts of things, I'm going to grab my iPad. If I'm going out to do a lot of heavy programming and coding, or I'm prepping a show and I want to do, you know, lots of research, I'm going to grab my laptop and I'm going to head to the coffee shop or what have you. And so each one of those experiences needs to be the best experience that I can have. But as I want to transition from one to the other, that also needs to be a seamless experience. And so that's really what Apple's working on with this whole concept of continuity. Messages. There are some really nice new things in the Messages app. And Apple even admitted Messages is the most frequently used app in iOS. So now you're going to be able to do things like name your message threads. So if you're doing group messaging, those sorts of things, you'll actually be able to give them some sort of descriptive name. You'll be able to add and remove people from the existing message. You can leave a thread. So if someone's pulled you into a conversation and you're done, you don't want to be in that conversation anymore, so you're not getting a bunch of alerts and things like that, you can leave the thread. More importantly, they are going to add do not disturb per thread. So this is going to be great if you're going into a meeting and you're participating in an ongoing text message and you're getting a lot of messages back and forth. You'll be able to just silence that one, but you don't have to silence all of them. So if I'm having another thread that's going on with, say, my wife, and I know I want to get those messages, say, on silent mode, those will still be able to come through. And I can just silence the other ones that are maybe from my friends or something like that. You're going to be able to share your location inside a message. And this looks like it kind of ties in with the Find My Friends feature, because when you turn it on, you can kind of set a time frame. You can kind of say, I want to share my location for an hour. I want to share my location for just today, or I want to share my location indefinitely with the people in this conversation. So they'll be able to see where you are and those sorts of things. And then they have this new details view, which kind of consolidates and pulls all the information related to a message that you're in or a thread that you're in all in one place. So you'll be able to see like all of the image files in a single sort of view and things like that. So that's going to make that a lot more convenient. And then a big new feature is they're adding tap to talk or tap to video. So you'll be able to send a quick audio message just by simply tapping a button or send a quick video message. And then those messages will also go away after a certain time period by default so that you're not eating up all the storage on your device. You'll have an option and a button to actually save them if you want to keep them. There's a little keep button, but you'll be able to send messages back and forth. So if you've ever used a tool like Voxer or Snapchat, you can kind of think of that sort of functionality. Again, I don't think Apple's trying to replace those applications with what they're doing because their stuff functions a little bit differently. Like, say, for example, in the case of Snapchat or these sort of self-destruct message apps, they're not implying that that's what happens here. And as a matter of fact, you have a keep button, so you can save anything that you're actually sent. This is more about just saving on your storage. Or if you're looking at like something like Voxer, it's not entirely clear that Apple's audio or video messages would be necessarily cross-platform. So who knows, you might be able to send an audio message to somebody on an Android phone, but can they send one back to you in the Messages app? I guess it would probably depend on the functionality of their phone or their device. So we're going to have some questions that need to be answered regarding that, but still some really cool new features happening in the Messages app. They focused a little bit on the enterprise, which I think was good. They mentioned that 98% of Fortune 500 companies are using iOS devices, and they added a bunch of new features and functionalities for the enterprise. If you're really into that, like I said, the presentation is up and available on Apple's website. You can watch it. I'll just mention a few highlights. Per message S/MIME. They have new device enrollment program that lets you auto-configure devices for the enterprise. So they made the example of you can give a worker the iPhone right in its shrink wrap package, and when they open it up and put it on your network, you can have it auto-enroll into your corporate program, install all of the applications, set up all the restrictions and things like that, the security measures that you need to have in place, all automatically. You're going to have integrated support with iCloud documents for different providers. So they mentioned Box.net and some of the Microsoft services and things like that. You'll be able to integrate with those corporate systems through the iOS devices. So those are really important things on the enterprise side. And Apple's actually making pretty big inroads, especially with iPads and iPhones and things like that in those environments. So it was good to see them putting a little bit of focus on that. Of course, they finally addressed one of the big elephants in the room. I guess there were a few big elephants this time around for this release. There were a few things we had heard about, the home automation stuff and the health stuff being the two big rumors leading up to WWDC. Well, they are getting into the health space. They mentioned the health app that will be available in iOS. It's going to be able to compile all of your different fitness stats and information in a single application. So things like heart rate, blood pressure monitors, weight, your activity in terms of steps, calories burned, those sorts of things. But it's going to integrate and work with the other applications that you have and other devices that you have connected into your iOS devices. So it's going to be an opt-in in terms of what data or information is shared. You will be able to allow data to be shared not only from the apps to Apple's health app, but also between the different apps. So if you have two different apps that want to share or communicate data back and forth, you'll be able to set that up and allow that data and information to flow. Within the health application, it will aggregate all that information and give you little dashboards and synopsises and summaries of all that information and acts as sort of the centralized store, again, of all that data that you want to allow in that platform. And one of the cool features that the health app is going to have is it's going to contain a medical ID or an emergency card that can be accessed from the dialer on your lock screen without a passcode. Again, you'll opt into this and you'll decide what information you want to put into your little emergency card, but it would be used by emergency people to be able to get information like, do you have allergies? Do you have any pre-existing medical conditions? Who's your emergency contact if you're in trouble? So they'll be able to get right at that. And you simply fill out the little card, enter the information, and then, it, like I said, it's available from the lock screen. And they are going to allow certain partners and applications to share that information with your doctors if you want to. Again, all of this is going to be opt-in. We don't have a lot of details on how they're going to handle all of the privacy and information. I think we're going to see a lot of articles saying how bad this is, you know, that this information is going to be something a lot of people are going to be worried about. But again, you don't have to opt in for this, right? You don't have to use the health application. You don't have to put any information in here. So it's really up to the consumer. And I'm trying to, you know, step back and remember and think about it that way, right? I don't have to share the information I don't want to share with my doctor. So people, I'm sure, are going to worry about, you know, what happens when the insurance providers are looking at all of our data. You know, are they going to up our rates because they see we're not going to the gym enough? Those sorts of things. If you worry about that kind of stuff, don't opt into it. Don't use the program. But Apple is working with the Mayo Clinic app to make that available to their network. They're working with one of the major health networks, providers of health data to a number of institutions, and they're going to integrate that with their health platform. So, you know, that could be good information, though, that you do want to share with your doctors, especially if you're in a situation where you're being treated for something. To be able to kind of have that remote monitoring and information flowing back and forth might actually be something that could save your life. So, you know, there's some good benefits to this. There's some concerns that we need to sort of watch over. But I think overall, it's really an interesting thing to see develop. And, you know, I think a lot of people are, we have iPhones and iPads in our pockets and on us all the time. So it just kind of makes sense. And the other half of, so the health app is the app that Apple's going to put out that's going to sort of aggregate this data and information. Health Kit was also announced, and it's more that tool for developers. It's the layer that's going to connect the different applications together. It's going to kind of set the protocols and say, here's the language we need to talk to be able to share this data and this information back and forth. And so developers can use HealthKit within their application to make information and data available to the health application, to the other applications, and again, all with your permission. So that was kind of the big announcement on the health front. Apple also talked about family sharing, something I was very happy to hear them talking about. So now we're finally, if you're in a family and you have different Apple IDs, you're going to be able to start to pull some of your information together. You're going to be able to have shared photo streams and calendars and reminders. You're going to be able to have Find My Friends in a special family group. So it's just your family members that you want to include. Find My iPhone, same sort of thing. So if your family members have different devices, even if they have different Apple IDs, you're going to be able to say, hey, these are all within my family group. I want to be able to monitor and track these sorts of things. And same thing goes for purchases on iTunes, the App Store, and the iBook Store. As long as all of the accounts are using the same credit card, under the same credit card in terms of purchases, you're going to be able to pull those together with up to 6 family members in a group. And another really cool feature, something I think that was put out to kind of address some of the issues Apple's been having with the whole in-app purchases and kids making in-app purchases without adults knowing or permission and running up big credit card bills. They now have a feature when you're using family sharing. If your child wants to make an app purchase or buy a song or a book or something like that, or make an in-app purchase, it will actually send a message to the parent's device saying, hey, they want to buy this. Do you authorize it? And if you authorize it, the transaction goes through. Otherwise, you can deny it. And so you're not going to have that sort of accidental purchase. You're going to get notified that, hey, they're trying to buy this thing. And so that's kind of a cool new feature. But just the fact that Apple's finally thinking about, you know what, we have people in families, they have separate Apple IDs. We need some ways to pull them all together. They're finally adding that functionality with the new family sharing. Then they talked quite a bit about photos. You're going to have a new iCloud photo library, and that photo library is going to be able to sync and store all of your photos on your device, not just the 1,000 that we currently have in PhotoStream. So you'll be able to have everything stored within iCloud storage. It is going to use your iCloud storage. That was another thing I noticed as I was watching the keynote. There's lots of things that are going to be tapping into iCloud. You know, the whole iCloud, I keep wanting to call it iCloud Documents, iCloud Drive. You've now got iCloud Photo Library. So Apple's still just giving you 5 gigabytes of free storage, but they have reduced the prices of storage if you need to buy more. So you're now going to be able to get 20 gigabytes of storage on iCloud for 99 cents a month. That's US. Or if you want 200 gigabytes of storage, it's going to be $3.99 a month. So what does that work out to? That works out to about $12 a year if you want 20 gigabytes. I think about almost $50 a year if you want 200 gigabytes of storage. So they are trying to make the storage a little bit more affordable, but they're definitely giving us some ways where we're going to be using a lot more of our iCloud storage. But you'll be able to put all your photos up there, and that's kind of cool because that means you don't have to keep them all stored on your device, right? You're going to have access to your full photo library, much in the same way if you've signed up for iTunes Match and iTunes in the cloud, you have access to your full iTunes library. You'll now have full access to your photo library. And they've improved the search quite a bit. So you're going to be able to get smart suggestions when you're searching based on location, based on finding photos near you, based on date. You can also search still, of course, by your albums. They added some new smart editing features that looked really incredible. So they showed a bunch of examples where you take that photo and maybe your subject's just a little bit dark. You're going to have simple one-click buttons that you can go in and adjust light and color balance and those sorts of things. They seem to do a pretty good job out of the box, but you can even drill in and get at specific controls and sliders if you want to. So they really bumped up the sort of simple editing that they're going to have in the Photos application. There's an auto straightening and cropping tool as well. Something that really wasn't announced but was pointed out by the unofficial Apple web blog, there's a new time-lapse mode in the camera. So if you want to take time-lapse photography, that's going to be built right into the camera application. And Tim Cook said it's coming in early 2015, but they are going to finally get rid of iPhoto. They're going to replace it with a new Photos application on the Mac, just like the Photos application on your iOS device. Right now, it looks like it's primarily a management application, doesn't have a lot of editing capability. I'm assuming Apple's doing the classic thing that they do when they redo applications these days, sort of ground up rebuild, start from scratch, start with the basics, and then expand upon that. So, you know, expect in 2015 when people move from iPhoto to Photos, there's going to be a lot of complaints about the lost functionality that we get, just like we saw with iMovie, just like we saw with Final Cut, those sorts of things. But Apple's really building a new foundation, and it looks really cool. It's going to be integrated with the iCloud Photo Library, so you can have, you know, all your photos and videos up online. And they are going to have a Windows version made available via the web, so you'll be able to do photos on your Windows PC when you're at work, manage those sorts of things, looks like through some sort of web interface. And it is going to, the iCloud Photo Library, I guess I should also mention, is going to support video as well. So just more storage that you might need to buy. But again, Apple's trying to make that a little bit more affordable. I think a couple people have done some analysis about the different online storage solutions and what's the most affordable. I don't think that Apple's is the most affordable per gigabyte, or at least I'd be surprised to find out, but still definitely more affordable than it was before. Then Apple talked a little bit about Siri, some really cool things coming in Siri. The one thing that I really wanted them to do that they did not announce or talk about was a Siri API for third-party apps. It doesn't look like we're getting that in this release, or at least they didn't announce it or let us know about it, and I would think that would be a pretty big key feature. They did announce, though, a new Hey Siri command, so you'll now be able to activate Siri if you want without having to actually touch or hold a button. You'll just simply be able to say, Hey Siri, and then give Siri the command. So Siri's going to be always on and always listening. Another thing is they did something that had been rumored. They announced officially that there is now Shazam song recognition built right into Siri, so you'll be able to ask Siri, hey, what song's playing right now? She'll be able to use the Shazam technology to detect and play that song. And they announced Siri support for 22 new languages. A couple new features were announced also for the China market. They're going to have support for things like lunar calendars. China's finally getting vector-based maps. China is becoming a really big, important market for Apple. I think actually in the opening presentations, Tim Cook specifically cited that growth in China was incredibly huge for iOS devices, and that a large percentage of consumers in China were switching from Android devices to Apple devices. So they obviously want to focus and improve the experience in China, and I think that's a good thing for Apple moving forward. That's a huge, huge market, and there's a lot of potential there. So that's good for Apple's bottom line. So that was kind of the things that Apple talked about. Since then, there's been a number of additional bits of information that have come out about the release of iOS 8. Specifically, developers have noticed that there is now resizable iPhone and iPad options in the Xcode app simulator. So this is a tool that is within Xcode to allow developers that without actually having a physical device to be able to test their applications. And there's always been different devices in there. So you could say, you know, I need an iPad, you know, fourth generation, or I need an iPhone running iOS 7, and then you could test your little application in there. They now have options that say resizable iPhone or iPad, and then you can actually plug in dynamic screen dimensions. So obviously the speculation here is that Apple's gearing up to get developers ready to be able to develop for multiple screen-sized devices. And it seems like if that's what's going on, we're looking at more dynamic interfaces that would probably have to scale and adapt to the screen size. So in my mind, I'm thinking sort of like responsive websites. We do this on the web now because we have no idea if our website's going to be being viewed on a teeny tiny smartphone all the way up to a 30-inch monitor, and you kind of have to adapt rather than, you know, building different interfaces for each device. You kind of make your device, your screens scalable, so things shift and move around, turn on or off dependent upon the interface. You know, maybe get smaller buttons here and those sorts of things. So I think that might be what's happening. I think it's not necessarily ideal for developers or users because they don't get the best absolute experience in all cases. It's been nice so far because when you have just one screen size or just a couple screen sizes, developers can kind of target those. But if everything has to be dynamic, you can't have that exact spacing, you can't have that precise precision control, and you don't know exactly where something might be, so you tend to kind of make some compromises in the UI. It'll be interesting to see how things work out. So I'm hoping that Apple's not going to get to that point where it's like Android, where we've got a million different size devices. I don't think we're going there. There could be two. That seems to be the strong rumor at this point, that we're going to have a 4.7-inch iPhone and a 5.5-inch iPhone at some point. I think that's likely to happen, and maybe this is just how they're going to handle that sort of thing. So that it was just something that was noticed with the release of the SDK. Another interesting feature, kind of piggybacking almost on the handoff thing, is your applications are going to be location aware, and depending upon your location, it can suggest an application or recommend the application from the lock screen that you might want to launch. So an example of this is, say you have the Starbucks application installed on your device and you're at Starbucks, a little Starbucks icon appears in the lower left corner in the same place that you would have your handoff icon. And when you swipe up on that, it launches right into the Starbucks app. Or it could be the Apple Store, your Apple Store app when you're at the Apple Store, or the Tesco or Vons app if you're at the grocery store, those sorts of things. Those apps are going to be able to be location aware. It's not really clear at this point whether it's strictly relying on GPS and map data, or if it also leverages maybe Apple's iBeacon technology. It seems like it would make sense that it's actually leveraging iBeacons, and you swipe up and then you simply get the associated app. So that's going to be a little bit of a time saver. Something else that's really, really cool, peer-to-peer AirPlay. So how many times have you been someplace, you want to AirPlay from one Apple device to another, from your iPad to your Apple TV, something like that, but you don't have a network available? Or maybe you want to give a presentation and you want to use AirPlay technology, but you're in a space where, again, you don't have a centralized network that you can connect to. Well, now devices won't have to be on the same Wi-Fi network or even connected to a Wi-Fi network at all to be able to use AirPlay. So you'll be able to work from iOS to an Apple TV. not really clear how Apple's going to handle security with it, but you know, you can kind of think of it like how it works with AirDrop, right? AirDrop does a whole peer-to-peer thing. You're going to be able to do peer-to-peer AirPlay, and I think that's going to take a lot of headache in certain situations out of the whole AirPlay experience. Something else a lot of people are going to be really excited about, RSS feeds are back in Safari, at least in a way. They're going to use the shared links feed, so you'll be able to go into the shared links and then go to subscriptions and add the current website you're on into your Safari shared links, and that's going to use the RSS feed to update articles and information within your shared links. So that's good. At least we're getting some RSS functionality back in Safari. Personally, I think I still am going to stick with the dedicated RSS readers. I've never been really happy with Apple's implementations, but I'll give it a shot when it comes out and see how it works. Maybe it'll be something that turns out to be useful. Another really nice one for developers, JavaScript is no longer going to be restricted in third-party apps. If you remember, few versions back when Apple updated the JavaScript engine inside Safari, those performance increases and things like that were limited to Apple's applications and Safari because of some of the sandboxing things. And any third-party apps that relied on JavaScript kind of had a little slower performing engine. Well, that restriction apparently has been lifted. Safari is going to have a new, even faster JavaScript processor in iOS 8, and third-party apps are going to have full access to all of that. So there was that. And then, of course, there's that giant, what I call the feature cloud slide. So Apple comes out and they kind of highlight the things that they want to highlight within the operating system at WWDC. But then sort of toward the end, they throw up this giant slide and it's got all these little words on it, this giant cloud of different features and things like that, of stuff that's coming in iOS 8 that they didn't specifically talk about. And there's always some really good juicy tidbits in there. I have a full list of these in the show notes. I think I'm not going to go through all of them because there's literally hundreds of them, but I want to point out some of the ones that I think are particularly cool. One is that you're going to be able to have separate focus and exposure controls within the camera application. They're bringing panoramas to the iPad finally, so you'll be able to do panoramic photos with your iPad. There is going to be a camera timer, so if you want to take timed photos, particularly good if you're a selfie kind of person, right? You can set it up on a timer and it'll count down and then take a timer. FaceTime call waiting was in there. The Alex voice is going to be made available for accessibility, which is a much higher quality voice that we've had on the Mac for a while. And if you're concerned about privacy, DuckDuckGo, the search engine, is going to be supported in Safari. And for those who don't know, DuckDuckGo is a search engine where they don't retain any kind of search history or information. It's a completely private search engine. So that's really cool to see that that is coming to iOS. And I think that's also coming to Mac OS X. So as far as what devices are going to be able to run iOS 8, it's going to be compatible with the iPhone 4S or later, fifth generation iPod Touches, the iPad 2 or later, and both iPad Minis. So the iPad Mini and the iPad Mini with Retina display. Apple is dropping support for the iPhone 4, so if you're an iPhone 4 owner, you're going to be stuck on iOS 7. But again, I think that's a pretty big list of devices that Apple is supporting. We're moving, you know, we're going to have this fall the iPhone 6, so I would not say that Apple is slouching in their backwards compatibility. You compare this to some of the Android devices and things like that out there, and Apple does a pretty good job with this. As far as when it's going to be available, it's available for developers now. They can get iOS 8, and it's going to be available in the fall for the rest of us. There is not a public beta program for iOS 8, so if you want to run iOS 8 at this point in beta, you are going to have to pay your $99 and sign up for Apple's developer program. So those two things right there, just Mac OS X, Yosemite, and iOS 8, those would have been huge announcements in and of themselves, right? Apple could have done the whole keynote on that. But nope, they still had a third part specifically just for developers. And I thought this was one of the coolest parts of the keynote because That's why we're all here, right? It's for the developers, for these guys that make the great applications and software that we know and love. And Apple was really updated a lot of things. And this is really where I personally, walking away from it, saw the most potential with what Apple was announcing. It's always nice to get an updated operating system and updated applications and these nice tweaks and new performance things and new features and stuff like that. But what I'm really looking for as somebody who watches and follows Apple is, okay, what are they doing? Where are they taking the company next? And I think a lot of the hints and clues were in the developer portion of the keynote, but you kind of had to step back to see it. So I'm going to fill you in on sort of what I saw and what happened, but let's run through some of the things that Apple announced, some of the bits and pieces that they let developers know about. First, they started off talking about the App Store. A lot of developers, that's how they get their applications out to market. This is a really important thing for them. So Apple's adding some new ways to help us find and discover applications. They're going to have a new Explore tab that's going to open up things like trending searches. Search results are now going to be presented in an endless scrolling format, making it easy to scrub through search results, things like that. They're going to show related searches. So when you do a search, there's going to be suggestions and related searches. They're going to have a new Editor's Choice logo on certain apps. So that's going to help find kind of the premium apps, the apps that you're really looking for, at least the ones handpicked by Apple. That's a little bit of a double-edged sword, I think, for developers, because, you know, how do you end up getting on the Editor's Choice list? That's going to be a really ambiguous thing. So I expect a little bit of backlash or a little bit of commentary on that one to emerge in the next coming weeks, and especially when the new operating system comes out. But a big thing, developers are going to finally be able to create app bundles. So they're going to be able to take multiple apps that they might release, bundle those together, and offer them up at a lower price. So an interesting tweet go out with some developers thinking maybe the app bundle thing will be able to somehow be leveraged to kind of offer up upgrades, upgrade-style pricing on certain applications. So maybe you can bundle your old app with your new app. I'm not sure exactly how they're thinking that might work, but then offer up that up as a discounted price. There was a little bit of an awkward moment when they were talking about the App Store stuff, because Tim Cook came out and said, hey, and now we're going to do app previews. And the audience erupted, and I got really excited too, and I think you know why, right? A lot of us are thinking app previews, that means Apple's going to have trial apps, right? You're going to be able to download an app, try it out for a trial period, and then have the option to buy it. Well, no, immediately he let the air out of the room, because he said, short videos that developers can put together and put up on their App Store entry. So they can do, I guess, a tutorial on how to use their app and make that available within the App Store. Not exactly, I think, what app developers were looking for. And if you go back and watch the video, it's a really interesting to watch, because it's uproarious applause for about a second, maybe a second and a half, and then they hear that short video thing, and then it kind of immediately drops down to like golf claps, like, oh yeah, not what we wanted, Apple. So hopefully Apple takes that as a cue and sees that developers are really looking for something more than just sort of quick videos. And then the last thing that they talked about was something they had acquired. There's, for those of you who aren't developers, there's a big developer tool that that emerged. It was a third-party tool called Test Flight. And it allowed developers to track and get people into beta testing programs and get their software out there. It made it really easy for them to go back and forth and iterate and get software out for testing. That software in the company was purchased by Apple. That's now been integrated into Apple's platform. So they're going to have Test Flight for made available for beta testing for developers in this next release. So that's all been integrated. And that received some pretty good response from the crowd there. And then they got into the SDK, which when we're talking about SDK or software development kit, we're talking about Xcode. That's the tool that developers use to actually build applications, both for the Mac and for iOS. This is the biggest release of Apple's SDK, they said, since they launched the App Store. There's over 4,000 new APIs. So it's going to take developers a while to parse through that and get their heads around it. But that's what WWDC is all about. They're in those sessions. They're in those labs. They're learning about all that stuff right now. But one of some of the key features, new functionality that's in the SDK that mean anything to us as end consumers, I just want to touch on a little bit. So extensibility, Apple is really opening up applications and the services that they can offer up to other applications with extensibility. This is going to mean more cross-app communication. It's going to mean developers are able to do a lot more with their applications and with the operating system in terms of exposing things, in terms of opening things up. But it's going to do it, I think, in a much more secure way. So you're not going to have a lot of direct app-to-app communication. I think the operating system here is going to be acting a little bit like traffic cop, making sure the messages are going to the right places and not sort of going outside their boundaries, those sorts of things. So some of the examples of that that they mentioned are things like document providers that are going to work with iCloud Drive. And they showed among some of the storage options that would be possible would be things like integration with services like Box.net or maybe Microsoft's OneDrive. That was something they talked about when they talked about the enterprise features. So you'll be able to have those things integrated with iCloud Drive, integrated with your applications, so that I would imagine when you bring up a save window or an open dialog box, if those extensions and services have been made available, you're going to see those as storage locations within the operating system. So it's not going to be a third-party app that you have to go through. That's also how the widgets that are going into Notification Center are going to work. They're going to work through this extensibility feature. Same thing with photo filters. So if you write a photo filter application, you'll be able to expose those through extensions and make those available to other apps, including the operating system. So when I'm using the camera app, say that's built into macOS 10, I can have the option to turn on my filters from my third-party application that is installed on my device. So that's some pretty cool stuff, right? That makes it easy to get at all of this stuff. And extensions can kind of have these various extension points. And that's sort of how Apple controls. The same way the third-party keyboards, by the way, are going to work through these extensions or this extensibility feature in the SDK. And the way they work is they have these various extension points. So Apple has opened up a bunch of areas of the operating system. They have the Today extension point, which is the thing that's going to allow you to create widgets that go into the Notification Center. They're going to have a Share extension point. So if you have a service, say like Pinterest, and they showed this during the SDK, you'll be able to make that available. So when you go to the sharing tab, you'll have a lot more features in and under that share button. Again, depending upon what applications you've installed and what services you've chosen to enable. Photo editing, same kind of thing. You'll be able to open up different filters and things like that. Editing features within photo applications, within the photo apps built into iOS. The Finder is going to be another extension point. That's where you're going to be able to use remote file storage services and macOS 10. On iOS, there's a storage provider extension point. So that's how you're going to be able to get at the documents that are in other storage locations for other documents or for the operating system. So you'd be able to get your documents more easily back and forth between applications, and those custom keyboards. So the ability to replace Apple's custom keyboard. And this is a huge thing. Apple is really opening up the operating system much more, and it's a huge thing for developers. So really where the power comes in here is just giving developers these tools, right? Now they have the tools, and it's going to be amazing to see what they go out and do with these tools, with their applications, and the kinds of things that they come up with. It's going to be a similar revolution that like what we saw when Apple first introduced apps. It really is kind of a big deal and a big update. Another area that Apple focused on with the SDK is Touch ID. There's now a Touch ID API. I think a lot of us were hoping that was going to happen. It means that third-party apps are going to be able to use Touch ID to handle unlocks. It's going to go and integrate with the built-in keychain. So you're going to be able to use your fingerprint for logging into accounts. It's going to eliminate the need for typing a lot of passwords, which I think a lot of us find to be a really big hassle, especially if you're trying to use a really secure password and different passwords on every site and those sorts of things. So another reason to get more of your passwords and data into the keychain. I've been doing that. I'm still a big 1Password user. I think I'm going to be a 1Password user for a long, long time. But the more convenient Apple can make it for all of us to be more secure with our devices and our passwords and things like that, I think it's a good thing. And expanding Touch ID to third-party developers, I think, is a great step forward in making that happen. There's some new camera APIs. I mentioned earlier that, you know, the camera is going to have the ability to manually control both focus, white balance, and exposure. Those APIs are being made available from the operating system to third-party developers. So your third-party camera apps are going to be able to take advantage of all of those. We talked about HealthKit earlier. Again, that's how Apple's going to be able to allow developers to tie their applications into their health platform and into the health application. And then they also talked about the other big kit, the other big thing that was rumored, and it's what Apple is calling HomeKit. And it's their foray into home automation. Now, it's not Apple actually making home automation devices and then linking them into their own software and stuff like that. Again, this is a layer. All of these kits are sort of layers or controls or code that developers are going to be able to use. APIs, I guess you could say, application programming interfaces developers can use to integrate their products and their services with the operating system, with iOS devices and with the Mac. And so you can think about it as creating a unified interface to control all kinds of different devices. And some of them might come from Apple, some of them and probably a majority of them are not going to be coming from Apple, but it provides that seamless integration so that regardless of how the manufacturer is making their stuff work, it's going to be able to communicate with Apple's platform and with the other devices that have tapped into Apple's platform. So Apple's calling it the Home Automation Protocol. And basically what it does, just in a nutshell, because I dug into this a little bit because I was curious how it worked. What it does is it sets up a collection of home automation accessories. So it breaks it down into, you have homes, which are a top level container. So think of this as your house, right? It's could be a single home, it could be multiple homes, it doesn't matter. And then within the homes, you have rooms. And then each room can have different accessories. So it might be a light, it might be a thermostat, it might be your home entertainment system, it might be your Apple TV. I don't know, anything that could be attached into the home automation system. Could be a garage door, trying to think, an appliance at some point, maybe your slow cooker, your coffee pot, your refrigerator. I mean, the list goes on and on, right? But accessories are all the things that are within different rooms and things like that. And then each thing can expose services within the home automation protocol. So it can say, for example, I'm a light, I have the ability to be turned on and off. Oh, and also I can be dimmed. So any single accessory can have one or sort of multiple services that they can make available to the platform. And then other things can then control that. So applications, for example, can say, okay, I want you to go to the bedroom and I want you to turn on the light and I want you to set it at 20%, right? And they can send that message using Apple's protocol, Apple's language, and then it doesn't matter who made the light or what language it talks, it will be able to understand that command and do whatever it needs to do to set those parameters. And then apparently you can also set up zones, which would be groupings of rooms in a single house. So those are optional, but you could have, you know, upstairs rooms and downstairs rooms. And so once you have all this sort of infrastructure in place, you can imagine the sorts of things where you can say, hey Siri, turn off all of the downstairs lights. Or, hey, Siri, is the coffee pot turned on? Those sorts of things. And then Siri would be able to respond. And once again, Apple has kind of made this in such a way where the operating system is managing all of this stuff and their platform is managing all this stuff, but you can have communication going all kinds of different directions. So Apple doesn't necessarily have to build an application. Or if you've invested, say, in a Nest thermostat and in some Wemo lights and maybe in a Schlage door lock, automated door lock, something like that, they all have their own little applications, but they really can't talk to each other. You can't script or automate those things together. But now a third party, some developer, could create a great application that allows you to control all those things and to automate those things so that, hey, when I leave the house, when you detect that I'm more than this far away from the house, go ahead and make sure that you turn off all the lights and that you lock the door. just in case I forgot to lock the door. You can have that kind of automation going on, but Apple doesn't have to build everything from the ground up. They're just building the infrastructure and they're giving you the control device in your iPhone or your iPad, and then they're letting everybody else worry about the other bits and pieces, which is really, really cool. So that was HomeKit. And then they also have CloudKit, which is a way for developers to tap into Apple's cloud drive technology, and they can eliminate the need to write any of their kind of server-side application logic. So it's going to handle things like authentication and the database stuff and assets and those sorts of things for them, and allows users to sign in to an application's document storage, cloud storage, using their Apple ID. There are some limits for developers. Actually, Craig Federighi announced CloudKit. He said, and we have CloudKit, and it does all this great stuff with limits, and sort of did it a little aside with limits. But the limits are pretty liberal, so I don't think too many developers are going to have a hard time with that. And especially if you're just getting started, you're building a cloud-based application, something that relies on cloud storage, this is going to be a good option that's built right into the operating system and get you up and running pretty quickly. And if you need more, I'm sure one, Apple would probably sell you more. Maybe, maybe not. It's not really clear on that with CloudKit. But even if they don't, there's a lot of other platforms that you could tap into out there. Apple also had some pretty big updates for game developers. They're introducing something called Metal, which is basically giving them almost direct access to the A7 processor so they can really speed up gaming performance, reduce a lot of overhead. Apple says it's going to be 10 times faster on cell draw rates, better GPU computation, and more efficient multi-threading, all built in. I don't know what a lot of that stuff means, but basically it just means games are going to get better and more impressive on your iOS devices. Also, they have updates to SpriteKit, which is something that is used by game developers to build casual games, and SceneKit, which was something that was available in Mac OS X, and now they are bringing it into iOS. It's basically an Objective-C framework for building little simple games and 3D interfaces, and allows you to kind of render a 3D scene pretty easily within the software, within the coding environment. And then a huge announcement was that they're going to have a brand new programming language. So to date, most of the applications that you have on iOS and on the Mac, they're written in a language called Objective-C, which was something that was based on the programming language C. But that language has been around for a really, really long time. Objective-C kind of layered object-oriented stuff on top of C, at least that's my understanding of it. And so it has a little bit of baggage. It has some history behind it. And so Apple really wanted to develop a new language that was specifically designed to be native to Cocoa and Cocoa Touch. And so they announced something called Swift. And the whole idea is to make coding faster, to make it easier. They're claiming that you can mark up code up to 93 times faster than you can in some applications over Objective-C. So much more efficient. They kind of showed some code examples. And this was one of the things I was most impressed about, is I've never seen a WWDC keynote that actually had code examples shown during the keynote. That's usually stuff that's reserved for after, when developers move off and shuffle off into the labs and things like that. They've always kept the keynote a little more marketing focused and high level, but it was great to see them actually showing some code on stage. I think a lot of people watching were like, what is this? What is going on? And a lot of it was even over my head. I'm a programmer, but I haven't done any real Objective-C kind of programming, but still really, really cool to see, and kind of got me jazzed and excited. But a whole new programming language, it's going to allow developers to make changes in real time and actually see their programs change right within inside the Xcode environment without having to do builds, which if you're a developer, you know, it often takes time to kind of build your application. So you got to write code, build it, wait a little bit, not too long these days, but a little bit to actually see what your code's doing. And then you got this whole back and forth. So there's going to be some time saving there if you can actually see your code being compiled and working in real time. And as far as transitioning, you know, because so much is written already in C and Objective-C, the good news is you're going to be able to combine Swift and C and Objective-C all within the same application. So there's kind of a nice transition point. And Apple has already made a iBook available. So you can go to the iBook store and there is a Swift programming guide that you can download and get if you want to start playing around with it. Something, you know, again, more on the developer side of thing, but any tools that we can give to developers to kind of make the whole process of making these great applications and stuff easier, I'm all for that. And, well, you know, time will tell if Swift is something that's really going to take off. But again, developers can continue to use Objective-C if they want. They don't have to switch over. But I think a lot are going to, and we'll be following Swift and see what happens with its development over the next months to years and things like that. So that was really all of Apple's big announcements at WWDC. As you can see, it's really, really huge, big stuff. And so I, like a lot of people, come away from watching the keynote and sort of parsing through all the blogs and stuff like that in just a fog and a haze. I mean, this is a lot to get through and a lot to talk about. And so hopefully I wasn't too rambly in this show, but that's just sort of what runs through your mind, right? But I tried to, in the past day or so, step back a little bit and look at all these bits and pieces. And as I was kind of looking at it, an idea hit me, and maybe I'm crazy. I'm gonna throw this out there, but I want to get it out there and on the record, because as I was stepping back and looking at these bits and pieces, it seems to me like what Apple is doing is opening up the operating system in a way that makes Apple and its products and services a bigger center of your digital life, but in a way where Apple is not owning all of what I'm calling sort of the endpoints or the data. They're recognizing that they don't have to have all of the services and the data and the devices that sort of build into and plug into this ecosystem, into this platform. And they're doing it in a real clever and interesting way, in my mind. They're not having to build everything, right? We saw things like HealthKit, and there's going to be all kinds of devices and technologies and services that plug into HealthKit. But the interface that we're going to be interfacing with HealthKit is going to be our Mac or our iPad or our iPhone. It's going to be an Apple product, and it might, in many cases, be an Apple application. In this example, health, right? You're going to go to the health app, and all of the things that tie into Apple's platform, whether they're made by Apple or not, are going to be plugged into that. So you're using Apple technology, you're using an Apple device, you're using Apple software to access this data, these sort of endpoints. And so what it seems like they're doing to me is they've always kind of had this sandbox model, and they've built this incredible sandbox. They said during this event, Apple has 800 million iOS devices out on the market now. 800 million. Just think about that for a minute. That is a lot of computers. That's a lot of computing power. That's a lot of screens. That's a lot of interfaces into people's lives and the things that they do. And all of those things are personalized. We all use them for different purposes. And we have different things that we tie into it. We have different apps that we use within that. And they're all disjointed at this point, right? If I want to do one thing, I go into this app. If I want to do another thing, I go into that app. Now Apple's sort of saying and developing a framework to say, hey, come play in our sandbox. Here's the rules. We know you all want to play in the sandbox. You want to be part of it because your customers are here, right? We have your customers. Your customers have these devices. They have your smart band, and they have your home entertainment center, or they have your television, or they have, you know, I'm just throwing this off the top of my head. There's a bunch of examples of this stuff. Like, we have all these things that tie in, but there's nothing to bring them together in sort of this cohesive way, right? We have different storage products. We have different cloud storage that we've signed up for. We have different services that we signed up for the web, social services. We have different sharing applications, right? I might go into Facebook to do one thing. Well, you know what? We don't really want to do all that. If I'm on a web page in Safari, I just want to be able to share it to all these different services. I don't want to have to copy the URL. I don't want to have to go into some third-party app. I just want to be able to click on the sharing button and see that service plugged in there, right? That's what these extensions are doing. So I kind of stepped back and went, you know, really what Apple has done is they've created now a way for these third parties who really what they want to sell is they want to sell their devices and they want to sell their services. I don't know that necessarily they want to have to worry about building complex software or control systems or what I'm calling views, right? Basically, the interfaces that we use to interface with these things, I don't think they want to spend a lot of time and effort doing that. They want to focus on their platform. So say you're a company and you're making cloud storage. You just want a platform that people are going to put their documents on. You're not selling necessarily, unless maybe you're Google, you're not selling advertising around that, right? You want people to pay for the service. You want people to put storage on your things. You don't want to have them worry about what application they're in, you know, that they're working in this app or that app and tying in. And we've seen developers, you know, addressing this by making their own APIs available, by their custom APIs. But now Apple's bringing that sort of thing into the operating system. They're building the hooks. They're building the places where different companies and different technologies and services can now tap into Apple's thing. But that's the key point there, right? Is this is going to ultimately be Apple's thing. So when I think about what I'm doing on my device, I'm just working with Apple technology. I'm working with Apple stuff. So it's almost like, in my mind, they're taking all of these other systems, they're stripping the brand off, and they're rebranding them as Apple. And it's really genius. And if you sort of break it down, so what we have is we have the endpoints. We have the point of interface with the consumer. And that point of interaction is more and more becoming Apple. Apple is the central hub. And then under that, you have all of what I'm calling sort of the connectors or the services. Those are all the kits, right? They're the tools that Apple is making available to developers that help them link their stuff into Apple's ecosystem. So you have HealthKit, and you have CloudKit, and you have HomeKit, and you have CarPlay, right? CarPlay is just about bringing my Apple experience into the display on my car. But in my mind, it's an Apple system, right? It's not whatever system the car manufacturer made. It's hiding that from me. And so suddenly you see then, I guess the last part that I didn't mention, so you have these little connectors, right? But they're connecting to data points. And those data points can be just a myriad of things. It could be my contact data, but it might not be just my contact data from my Apple database. It could be my Facebook contacts and my LinkedIn contacts and my Google contacts. But guess what? I'm going to pull all that together through these interfaces. I'm just going to have that available from my lock screen. I'm going to see, oh, I was communicating with this person or that person. And it might be that that person I just sent a Facebook chat or did an iMessage with. Right? But it's not going to really differentiate that. But my experience is still an Apple experience. It's not a Facebook experience. It's not a LinkedIn experience. Same kind of thing with these health devices. Same kind of thing with the home automation stuff, right? I am just going to be using an app. It could be an Apple app. It might be a third-party app. But really, my interface for that is the device. And you look at what Apple announced at WWDC as a whole, and I'm kind of seeing all these pieces come together. And so Apple is really, we've talked about, you know, Apple wants to be the center of our home automation experience or our home entertainment, or Apple is going to be the central point of, you know, the music that we listen to, right? That was talked about when we did iTunes. I really think Apple's endgame here is much, much bigger. They're looking at a platform and building an infrastructure where Apple is the center of your digital life. It is the thing that you grab and you use to control whatever you want to control. And again, it's going to be real personalized, but at the end of the day, for us as users, it's going to be an Apple experience. It's going to be the thing I do on my iPad in the Finder, right? I get at my documents, but my documents might be in the cloud. They might be on my Mac. They might be on my external hard drive. They might be in Dropbox or Box.net or OneDrive or insert whatever service wants to plug into Apple's ecosystem here. And a lot of people are going to say, well, the limiting factor is people are going to want to are going to want to plug into this sort of ecosystem that Apple's building. Well, Apple has made it almost impossible, I think, to say no. And I think a little of the giddiness that we saw and a little of the arrogance we saw in the keynote was Apple knows this, right? They have 800 million devices that people want to tap into these services. And so if Apple says, this is how you're going to do it, then I think there's going to be a lot of people that are going to want to play along because consumers, their customers are going to demand it. And they're going to see their competitors going in. This is the other thing, right? Their competitor's going to go in, their competitor's going to be there. And people aren't that loyal when it comes to a lot of these things, right? There are a lot of cloud storage services. There are a lot of different health devices that I can pick and choose from. And if I own an iPad or I own an iPhone and you're not going to play with the system that I want to use, well, guess what? Your competitor is, and I can go buy that thing and you're going to get left in the dust. So I think they recognize their sort of position of power. And I think nobody else is thinking about integrating in this way. But at the end of the day, at least for me as a consumer, this is what I really want. I want one place, one device, one system that I can use to kind of manage everything. And I don't want to have to think a lot about the minutiae and the detail of how it all links together. That's what developers think about. And that's what was so cool about this is like a lot of these tools are for developers to kind of pull this stuff into this Apple ecosystem and make it happen. So that's what I got really excited about with the keynote and sort of what I'm seeing coming away from it. So I'm even saying, and I shared this idea with John Martellaro at the Mac Observer. We wrote a little piece. If you want to see that, I'll try and put a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically sort of summarizing this thing, and me being the programmer geek, I kind of see this as Apple's model view controller methodology with the iPhones and iPads and Macs and things like that being our views. And then we've got all these kits as controllers and then all these data endpoints as our models. And Apple's really kind of pulling it all together. And it's the next big thing from Apple, in my opinion. So a lot of people think the next big thing from Apple is some sort of hardware product or device. I really think it's bigger than that. I think people are going to look back and look at this and go, wow, this was the turning point. This is when Apple pulled all this stuff together and became an even bigger powerhouse and sort of changed our lives again. This is really disruptive because it's going to make it a lot of people very locked into Apple's ecosystem and very hard for a lot of Apple's competitors who haven't been focused on this and are more disjointed and face more challenges than Apple do to come and compete with this. So anyway, that was my thinking. I know, kind of leaving you with some big, heavy thoughts, but I'm hoping to get a lot of feedback from you. Let me know if you think I'm on the mark here or if I'm crazy, but I've shared this with a few people, and a lot of people, after I say it, seem to think the same thing, or you can kind of see it. So I don't think I'm crazy, but I'm happy to hear opinions any which way. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that is going to do it for the episode for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PF Pen, Disk Label. Also, check out Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. All great applications. You should own them all. Check it out. Get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, if you want to get some cash for that old iPhone, iPad, or Mac, you can find out what it's worth over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed. If you have feedback for me, you can send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9, and you can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website at maccast.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also, check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a community on Google Plus. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.